understanding that the journey is the destination. You are in that part of it. It's going to suck, but, you know, smell the roses a little bit and think about the fact that you're getting to do this cool, interesting thing that so many other people don't get to do.
Welcome to Hitting the Ceiling, the show for entrepreneurs and leaders who refuse to let a ceiling become the end of their story. Eric V. Holtzclaw is a serial entrepreneur who has spent his career helping companies understand why customers buy and how businesses scale. The tension in his story is that he can build the delivery machine, but the revenue growth has been the reoccurring ceiling. That ceiling pushed him to sell his research business in 2012, and it also set the stage for Liger, which began almost accidentally as he started helping CEOs clarify their businesses. Now, after selling Liger and then buying it back, Eric is considering the M&A and deciding whether the next level will require more risk than he's used to, and defining and redefining the ICP, rebuilding the pipeline. Eric, welcome to Hitting the Ceiling.
Thanks so much for having me.
It doesn't happen often, but you sold Liger, then you bought it back. I don't hear that story too often. It does certainly happen. But tell us about that. How'd that happen? Why did it happen? Why'd you buy the company back?
So you talked a little bit about being a recovering technologist. And so I have a marketing firm that gets into the technology side of businesses often. And that's always something that we've relied on partners for. And we found a partner that we were working with and they did the technology really well. We had the marketing side. They had one client that represented a significant amount of their revenue. And so they were looking for diversification. And so it looked like, hey, let's put these two things together. We can use the marketing portfolio as a way to kind of come in, start to open up the client, and then move them over to the technology side. And it would be a diversification for them. Well, about a 9 to 10 months into that merge of the two businesses, they received notice from that large client that they were cutting the service. And so instead of, or cutting their, you know, what they were buying, the revenue from them. And so they decided that they needed to re-entrench into some new technology and go a different avenue, which meant that they were not willing and able to make additional investments in Liger, which is part of what we were looking for, and actually started to make some cuts at that core business, which would have impacted the portfolio that we've had for years. When we sign a client, they stay with us for a very long time. And so there were parts of the agreement that allowed us to bring the business back out and stand it on its own. And so that seemed to make the most sense, mostly for our clients. We did it, it was client facing. I wanted to make sure that those clients, they rely on us for marketing on a regular basis. We are their outsourced marketing firm. And for us to not have those resources available to them was not going to do the greatest service. But during that transition, as you also mentioned, we had switched who we were going after because we were going after clients that could then use the technology piece. So, building the kind of thing that we do, it takes 8 to 9, 10 months to get someone to sign. So that pipeline got to be reestablished at that point.
Now, I have to ask about the company name. Because, yes. When you say Liger, in my generation, I think of Napoleon Dynamite. You take a lion and you put a tiger and you get a Liger. Does the name of the business have anything to do with Napoleon Dynamite?
That's everything to do with Napoleon Dynamite. So I have started and founded businesses forever. And you have to name them typically something really boring. And we were establishing a marketing firm by merging my strategy business with an execution business. So we needed to rename the company. So my company was Laddering. It was another company that was a strategy, or sorry, execution company. And we're going through names and we wanted to find something that was powerful, meant combined, that type of thing. And Liger came up as an option. I've always loved Napoleon Dynamite. I like that kind of, it's kind of a 70s, 80s setting. You're not exactly sure, right?
Right.
We have friends we've been friends with. They're the godparents for my daughter. And they've never forgiven us for making them watch the movie because they only watched it once. And the problem with Napoleon Dynamite is you got to watch it 2 or 3 times to really get the joke. And we can't get them to go back and watch it again. So when it came up as an option, I was like, number one, that's amazing. Number two, my friends will always, every time I see them, they're going to be like, I can't believe you named your company after that. So we named it Liger and we lean into it heavy. Napoleon is kind of he's the backstory. We have a disco ball in the middle of our space. We have a big, huge orange couch when you walk in. So there's a a lot of nods to kind of that 70s, 80s feel. And it's appropriate for the company. The company is very geeky, you know? And if you notice in the story, Napoleon is making Pedro class president.
That's right.
That's what we do. When we work with our customers, we are making, we're shining the light on them and we're getting them elected. That is our intent.
Yeah. Love that. Love that. Now, you were talking about the revenue ceiling, growing the business. Why do you think you keep hitting, or that revenue ceiling keeps coming up? I'm talking about the research business sale, the misalignment around the revenue leadership. Why that ceiling specifically? And what was underneath it?
Thinking about, you know, right person, right seat. Like if you think about where people live in the organization, I am not an extrovert. I am barely an ambivert. So when I've run businesses in the past, I'm kind of the behind the scenes Wizard of Oz. And I'm very operationally oriented. I can either sit in the visionary integrator seat kind of comfortably in either one, depending upon my role. And my early career was working for crazy CEOs who would go and raise money, and then I would build the scaling organization behind them. I mean, they literally would raise money and be raising money for the next one. I'm like, don't we need to build the company we just got money for? So that's where I would sit.
We have to go do this now?
Right. Like, we got money from the people. They're expecting us to build the business. So someone should probably go do that. So I'll go do that while you go off and raise money for the next piece of it or whatever. And so that's kind of how I came up and learned. And in the research space in particular, we had a company that could deliver 250 to 300 research projects a year. They were between 6 weeks to 90 days in length, typically. And we had capacity for 2 to 3 times that. Like, we had built ourselves to scale on that side. I had someone else who was in the seat who was doing the kind of outbound and all that. And I feel like he got to a point that he was comfortable. And so he didn't really want to make additional money. Like, it was, you know, and there are people, depending upon where you are, you will find salespeople who, once they start making a certain amount of money, it's hard to get them to sell something else, right? They don't necessarily see it as I always see it as, you know, points on the scoreboard. It's not really about the money. Yeah. And so we were misaligned. And I use this saying a lot. If I say the word skiing, you may have thought of snow skiing. I think of water skiing. So we had not, at the beginning of the business, defined what we both were looking for. I wanted a business that would continue to scale, not because I necessarily wanted to be mega rich, but because that's what I like. I like the impact of being able to hire additional people, seeing something kind of grow organically on, you know, and move. And I believe that he wanted more of a lifestyle business. And we went that way for almost 10 years until I sat down with him at a lunch one day and I said, so, this business is not scaling and it's not really big enough for the two of us to, you know, meet what we would want to do. I said, so if we don't grow in the next year, one of us has to go. And so I think he kind of thought I was kidding, and I really wasn't. And so 12 months later, we were basically the same revenue number, and I took him to lunch and I said, so it's, you know, been 12 months. We said 12 months ago that if the business hadn't grown, that one of us would need to go. I said, if you left, what would you do? He said, well, I guess I could become a contractor for the business and continue to sell. And I said, well, that sounds like a terrible idea. I said, I'll be angry every time I write the check, like whatever. I have some things I want to go do. And so I'm the one who sold my interest back in the business and went off and swore to my wife I'd never start another business. And here I am with... I'm to 3 right now. So yeah, but it was a good transition because it forced me into the revenue generating side. So I had to become like the primary main sales guy and really learn how to go out and shake hands. And, you know, it's when I started writing for Inc. and doing the radio show and doing all the other things I do to network and meet people. So I had to solve my own problem on that side, but it was finding where people's strengths are, like what is it that they do well? And I can do the sales. I still think that I'm a better killer than a hunter. So, you know, you have hunters, killers, gatherers, farmers in the sales world. And I love to go into a deal that's been warmed up. It's something that you're constantly working on.
When you think about the three businesses, well, first of all, what are the three?
Liger is the marketing firm. I have a real estate company that owns our building and we're doing a little bit more with that. And then I also have a foundation. So I have a child who is a practicing artist we give money to artists. Kind of, I don't know if you've heard of Giving Kitchen, but if an artist ends up in a situation where they lose their studio or they can't complete a project, we come in and provide emergency grants and things on that side. And I like it as a challenge because I've been in nonprofit on the board and things, but I've never run a nonprofit. So it's like, hey, so how does this work? So it's a little toy. A lot of other people play golf on the weekend. I typically start companies. That's
kind of, I mean, why not?
Why not?
I think there's nothing wrong with your hobby being businesses. It's totally good.
I wrote an article, you know, because people would tell me, why don't you go get a life? And I wrote an article for Inc. I was like, my work is my life and I'm not going to apologize. Like, I enjoy it. And I've been very early able to figure out how to integrate it into my personal life. So I don't, you know, I'm still going to go on a trip. I have an RV. I'll go, you may find me, you know, somewhere across the country because I know you can work in multiple places and get things done. And if I'm, but if in the middle of the day, I want to go to lunch and just peace out, I'm going to peace out for a couple hours.
People say the same thing to me quite often, like, Mark, why don't you like take up golf or something? Like, why are you always just reading and learning and growing a company? I'm like, well, it's kind of the same thing. Like, you go out on a golf course and it's very frustrating and it doesn't go your way. And, you know, I just choose to do it in air conditioning and you're outside with the bugs. Like, why would you do that?
100%. We lived on a golf course and we belonged to a golf club for a while. And I would take people out and I would always get asked about halfway through from the poor twosome that had been assigned with us, now, which one of you is the member? And I'd be like, that's me. I know I'm a bad player, but I'm not upset about it. So as long as you're not upset about it, we'll be good, right? Like, just let me enjoy the golf cart and all that. And I think that nothing wrong with sports and, you know, some of those things, but from a business perspective, you can always see the impact of what you've done. You know, like, you've brought a thing to life, right? And you've got people who rely on it and customers who, you know, many people, many constituents who rely on it. So it has this organic feel to it. I am not artistic as my child is, but I do feel like that's my art, is like, how do you make it work and walk the tightrope along the way?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a continuous puzzle. It's a challenge. It's mentally stimulating. It's always different. You talked about the conversation of the lifestyle business versus the company that wants to grow, and you're in the growing camp. At EOS, we have a core value: grow or die. And really, the thought there is, if you're not growing, you're most likely in decline. Do you think that a lifestyle flat, not growing person and or business is an actual strategy that works?
I think it's a conscious choice. If you're going to do a lifestyle business, then pick an easier lifestyle business than the most of the ones I've done. So if I were, you know, yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is like, this is too hard a business to be a lifestyle business. So if I want to do a lifestyle business, then it should be something, you know, and I like to, insurance is potentially one. You work really, really hard. You build a book of business, maybe in financial advisement where it's a single person who's out there. You're not, don't have a big staff, those types of things. But you need to be very, very, very clear with yourself which one you're building. And there's nothing, literally nothing wrong. Like, I've interviewed over 1,000 entrepreneurs. They fall into like these two categories of either being a rectify or a magnify entrepreneur. And then there are people who are not really built to be entrepreneurs. And that's not a problem. It's fine. It just, you know, that's great. You probably had a wonderful childhood. There's not this thing after you that's, you know, trying to make you drive you this direction or the other, but you need to face it and understand it. And when I've done, I typically lean into like the CEO. That's who I like to talk to and work with, because they're the ones that the way the company follows. And so if there are patterns in that CEO that continue to repeat, their business is, it's going to show up in the business. And they have to be honest with themselves of what those patterns are so that they don't take themselves in a bad place. And so someone who's really looking for a lifestyle business, you need to build it as a lifestyle business. Like, you've got to really think about it that way.
You talk about a rectify entrepreneur and a magnify entrepreneur. Can you tell us a little bit about what each of those things mean to you?
I was in the middle of deciding what I was going to do with the research firm. And I've been told that I need to start standing on stages and being like this extrovert that I'm not. And so that's when I started podcasting. And I was podcasting way before video, and I did it on audio. And it was a way for me to practice having conversations with people and, you know, understanding. And it's like, well, what topic would I want to think about? And I said, well, I want to talk to entrepreneurs. I want to understand what gets in the way of them building a good business. And I expected to find out finances, you know, support from family and friends, like all the kind of usual suspects. And so as I did those interviews, I learned this pattern that entrepreneurs fall into two categories. There are rectify entrepreneurs, which are rectifying something from their past. So someone, when they were 8 years old, told them that they would never amount to anything, that they were not worthy, that they would not succeed. And they are building their business to say, I'm going to show you.
Through you. So,
through you, right? And they live their life like in that world. Rectify entrepreneurs, you have to be aware, and many entrepreneurs are not. So you need awareness of where your source is coming from, because it does drive how your business succeeds, how it doesn't, those types of things. So 80% of entrepreneurs in my research are rectify. Most of them are. Then there's about a 15 to 20% that are magnify. And a magnify entrepreneur typically creates a much better business. They're the ones who like build these beautiful businesses that just scale and do the most amazing things. And Steve Jobs is a magnify. And the reason he's a magnify is if you read his biography, there's a point in which he talks, I think he's around 8 years old, and he goes to his parents and he says, he finds out that he was adopted. And so he goes to his parents and he says, hey, mom and dad, I was adopted. Someone didn't want me. And Steve's parents looked at him and said, oh no, Steve, you don't understand. We chose you. You were chosen. And so Steve Jobs, and if you read the rest of his life and the way he lived pretty chosen. He like took that in and absorbed it. And so building big businesses around it, kind of not following the rules. So understanding where that source is coming from is really important. It's really important in the relationship between the leader of the business and then those that are following them, so that that way they can fall into traps if they don't look at it correctly. And you can kind of wreck a rectify if you don't handle the unveiling of that well, because then they realize potentially the source of what they're building isn't for themselves, it's for someone else.
Now, can a rectify entrepreneur become a magnify entrepreneur?
A rectify, in my opinion, can become an aware rectify. And that's when they're more... So it's about awareness. Like I've been asked often, you know, what's the biggest thing that a CEO of a business needs to be, you know, what skill set do they need to have, whatever. It is awareness. It is that, you know, healthy understanding of where they sit, what drives them, why they're doing what they're doing. And from there, they can recognize those cyclical traps that they put themselves in. That is why I often come in as like the co-CEO, you know, maybe that was the business I was never going to do anything else different, right? So like when I left the research firm, I became the right-hand guy of a bunch of CEOs helping them scale their businesses, and their marketing departments were a hot mess. So I would just take over marketing while I was there. I was like, well, I'm here, like, let me fix marketing. And so then I ended up with a bunch of businesses where I'd fix the operations and the marketing was still an ongoing consideration. So that's how that business kind of came to be. And a lot of what I did was just, it was therapy. It was like sitting with them and talking through, you know, how did you get to where you are? Why do you continue to do these things that are sabotaging? And if they are not bought in to what the business is building or doing in a way that's going to be healthy, then the business is never going to reach its full potential.
Just kind of digging in the aware, I start to think about purpose. And there's certainly entrepreneurs that I've had conversations with that, yep, and myself included, start out as the rectify entrepreneur. I had a relative tell me exactly as you said, like, you were going to end up nothing and poor and like you have no shot at life. And I'm like, screw you. Bring it.
Don't tell me I can't do it.
Totally. And that was definitely a motivator. But I have to say that somewhere along the line, I was just like, you know what? That doesn't really serve me very well. And I guess it could be the nature of what I was doing. I started to see the impact. I started to see just the positive impact that I was having on employees, on customers. Then it was also what very much attracted me to EOS and becoming an EOS implementer. You see all these aha moments, these transformations occurring with these leadership teams and with these other entrepreneurs. You start to get really clear that this is my purpose, and I'm living out this purpose as an entrepreneur, impacting those around me. Where until today, until this conversation, I totally forgot about what drove me in the past. So that's why my question around, can you, like, okay, that served me for a while, and now, who cares?
Yeah, I guess it depends on like how you reflect on it. What's interesting, you talk about EOS. So I went into this kind of operational world where I was working with kind of right-hand guy to these different CEOs, and I found the EOS at that point. So I was subscribing very similar things to them. I'm like, okay, we need to do this first, second, and third. We need to look at these things. And then EOS, I discovered it about the same time. And if they wouldn't adopt EOS, then I knew they weren't ready for change. Because often when I would come in, they're like, what's been serving me in the past is not going to serve me in the future. And EOS became my like way of testing them. So like if they weren't willing to adopt EOS, then I knew they weren't serious, right? So I would say that having talked with you now for a period of time, you were ready for something else. You were ready to move on. You were ready to understand, you know, to have accepted it and to move. Many people and entrepreneurs are often, you know, blamed that they love change. But people really don't like to change, and they don't like to face those things that they need to face. And so they're in this place where they've created and done this thing, and they're still kind of living in the grime of it unless they can have some time to really deal with it. What I like about EOS is it is about, you know, IDSing something and having honest and open conversations. And if someone's not in a place to do that, then they may not get their business to the point where they're really going to be able to scale it. It's always going to kind of stay stuck where it is.
Right. The obstacle's the way, right?
I mean, you're talking about hitting the ceiling. Like that is, you keep hitting the ceiling, and the ceiling can be, I can't keep staff, I can't get revenue, like whatever that ceiling is. Well, what's the root cause? Like why? Let's go back and look at the root cause of why that's happening. And we have to face it honestly and openly. And are you willing to change it or not? And if not, it's a tension. And if it's a tension, then how do we work around it, right? So it's a really interesting, my background from going from technologist and working with these crazy CEOs to running a research firm where it ran so well, I ended up doing research. I was out like interviewing people. I'd learned how to do that part. So I feel like I probably should have been a therapist. Like that's probably what I should have done. Marketing is kind of that, you know, it understands who your customer is and what they care about and how do you apply technology to it to make them successful. But sitting and saying like, okay, let's get down to the root. Like where are, and even if you're not willing to change based on the root, at least you understand it. Like you know why you're doing the thing you're doing, you know? Like that's such a step forward than just living in some place where you are unaware.
And when you think about your three companies now today and thinking about getting what you want and solving those issues, what is it that you want from Liger Marketing? What's your 10-year target, your core target? What's your 3-year picture? What obstacles, barriers are presenting themselves that you need to think about and work on? And what are you working on?
Yeah, so with Liger, we were the largest VC placement in one of the deals I did back in the 90s. I've done the PE route. I've seen tons of merger and acquisition. And I'm saying all of that because we talked about merger and acquisition. We want to buy some companies that are founder-led agencies where the person is really good at some component of marketing but may not be great at scaling or doesn't like it. Like, I'm sorry, the, you know, like the operational components of it, you know, because it's typically not why people get into that. So I want to build the antithesis to the PE market, and, you know, which makes all the financial people hate me because it's like, oh no, you don't want us to go sell it for $1 billion. And I'm like, literally, I don't. So I would like to establish a long-standing brand. It's why it's not Holtzclaw Incorporated. It's called Liger, which is a, you know, it's not my name. It's not that kind of component. marketing, in my opinion, is in this kind of law firm accounting firm transition. So law firms and accounting firms have the people who understand the areas of expertise really well, and they last for a long time because you have people who know those practice areas. So my dream is that Liger outlasts me and that it becomes a, you know, kind of partner-led organization where we're bringing in partners who have those different areas and that we're just a good cash-generating business. Like just a good cash generating business. And marketing, seeing a lot of roll up and acquisition from a PE and whatever perspective, I've never seen a company go through that in a way that is healthy. Like it just isn't the business it was before. So if somebody wants a paycheck, and I know, again, sorry, like it sounds like I don't like money. I do like money, but it's, there are ways to do it that you could preserve the, what you've built, right? So for me, 10 years from now, I'm not really day to day on Liger at all. I'm, you know, there's partners who are running the business, and Liger outlasts me as a firm that's known in the marketing space, just like some of the big law and accounting and, you know, firms like that. Small little dream, but it's not, there's a company here in Atlanta that's buying companies like ours, and they offered to buy us after we came back out on our own, and they're doing a kind of PE route, and it sounds terrible. Like it doesn't sound, you're not working to do the work. You're working to get the payday. I like the work. I really do. I like the work. I like working on the clients with our team members, things like that. So call me weird, but that's where I fit.
Well, why don't you think that PE roll-up strategy works? And who is sort of the loser in that adventure in your view?
Most of the time, I think everyone is. Like, I don't really, because we work with, you know, a lot of companies that are PE backed, and I get it. You know, they're rolling up, and you see the death of lots of brands around that. They're so focused on the numbers, you know, with the sake of quantity over quality. And that is, I talked to a guy one time, and there's East Coast and West Coast views of kind of how you do investments and look at things. And I'm very East Coast. I'm from Atlanta. I'm Southern. You know, how do you make good revenue? How do you generate the business and move it forward? You have people who buy businesses that don't know how to operate them. Like, why are you buying? You don't know how to operate this business. Like, this is a tough business to understand. And I'm in a bunch of M&A groups because we make money off M&A companies. We love working with buy-side companies where they brought two or three together and they're trying to figure out how their brand moves forward and what does the technology look like. No one in the sell side seems to ever pay any attention to that. Like they look at the accountants look at it. It looks good on paper and the lawyers say we think can pull it together, but no one's very rarely have they considered what's the internal messaging going to be? What's the external messaging going to be? So they expect 1 + 1 = 3 and 1 + 1 = about 0.7. They've confused their customers, they've confused the employees, the objectives. They're not establishing a BHAG in a way that means anything to anyone. The mission and visions and values are all a mess. So it's a very strong word. It feels kind of Ponzi scheme-like at times. You know, like we're putting all these things together and it's going to be great. And then you look back 3 years later and you're like, it's so rare for them to have accomplished what feels like a purposeful goal.
I'm assuming then too that it's really the sale. It's a financial engineering activity from one to the next, to the next, to the bigger PE, to the bigger PE, to the bigger PE after that. And the customer may or may not win through that. Of course, I've met quite a few PE firms, and there's a lot of really good people who run private equity firms, but it's not a fit for everyone. And the strategy, who you select, is really, really important as your PE backer. And what the thesis is and what they're going to do with the company. And I don't think very many entrepreneurs take the time to figure out like, that sounds good. We're just going to take the check and we're going to do this thing and it's going to turn out great. And it doesn't always.
It doesn't. And I'm not wronging anyone that wants to go that route, right? Because like, that's great. You know, You should always have a number and you should be ready to take the number. And I've heard that and whatever. It is in ways a lightning strike for a lot of people. And I've also talked to a lot of people who are in those positions with regret, you know, because it's like, I did it. Now, what am I doing next? And building a business is not an easy thing. Like, now you got to stand something else up. I mean, when I was doing the research firm, I was in a Vistage group and they were my kind of informal board of directors. And anytime anyone would talk about selling their business, we'd say, well, what would you do if you sold the business? Well, I'm going to go to the beach. Right. What are you going to do 30 days after you sell the business?
If that, maybe
you're
four.
Not going to be on the beach for 30. Right. Should you be so tied up into your business? Maybe not, but it's harder to make it successful if you don't care at that level. Again, end in mind. So there's lifestyle business. There is one that you want to kind of hold and scale. And there is the, no, we're building it to sell. And so knowing where you are, what that looks like, and we are firmly with Liger in the middle category. I believe strongly there's a lot of agencies out there right now that, you know, have an amazing talent, but don't necessarily know how to do all the things to operationalize the business. And they're also not sure how to apply AI, because AI has had this undercurrent impact to marketing. I've typically built businesses based on a technology change, not been in a business that was impacted by one. And so if you, you know, went to school for design and now all of a sudden you're running an agency, you're not exactly sure, how do I apply this AI thing? We're technically savvy enough to have the platform to say, hey, you keep doing what you're doing. Like, we're not going to make you become an AI expert because that's not appropriate. You're really good at brand or voice or whatever, and we'll scale the business in a way that that gets you to that next level and makes it fun. Like, it should be fun, right? Don't get up every morning. I'll talk to you. Yeah, it should be fun. Should make you cry.
So, I mean, hopefully you're having more fun than you're crying, but you know, both is probably okay.
Yes.
Right. Right. Now, when you think about the AI, you've obviously have some technology that you're using. What do you think the impact AI will have on marketing broadly as a discipline for the future? I'm seeing a premium on writing that is real and authentic and not AI generated. I see that people's pattern recognition almost immediately, if you're a user of AI, you pick up on the AI tells, whether it's graphics or language or video for the most part. It's just kind of a little bit off and you're unsure, but it's a little bit off. How do you think the future looks with that? Does the technology get better where we can't tell? Or do we see a ever increasing premium on human generated writing and content and graphics and marketing?
So the cop out answer is yes.
Yes.
To all of that. So I believe that AI does get better. Like, we're at think about the adoption of this. And what's been interesting to me is the forced adoption. So when you start off with old enough now to, AOL dial-up and internet and all those kind of things, social media, you didn't have to adopt those technologies. But now the way AI is being rolled out, it's so embedded in so many things that you're used to using. You're using it even if you don't know you're using it. And so there's this greater adoption to it that's kind of forced on people. So that's had a dramatic impact specifically on marketing as it relates to how people find you. So we do a lot of work in AI visibility for our clients. So like, if you're not showing up in the AI results, you don't exist any longer. That's harder for smaller companies to do unless they're doing all the right things around citations and original content and all that has to happen. It's fun for me because during a period of time with marketing about 3 years ago, you could game the system and win. Like, you could just game the system and you were going to win. Now we're back to the good old tenets of what marketing should be. Like, it's authentic, it's trust, it's authority, it's all these things. So leaning into that, the AI is going to get better. It is my hope that the AI is never going to have the emotions that we do as a human. And so it takes a human to look at something and know that it's just a little bit off, or that it needs to be this way, or to really understand what a person's telling you. So that is that human in the loop, human first, AI second. We will never call ourselves an AI marketing firm. We will call ourselves a marketing firm that uses AI, just like any marketing firm back in the day during the internet. You had internet marketing firms and you had social media market, like, wrong placement of the word, put it at the end, because
yeah, right.
There's going to be another phase, right? So it's been interesting to see, and that's, I had kind of said years ago that I thought marketing should be more like a law firm or accounting firm, where you have people who understand the practice areas, and then you have people kind of below it who are ready to step into those seats. And you had a lot of execution layer below it. that was true in law firms as well. They had paralegals running around. You know, they had to read the books and come up with what the case law was and those kinds of things. Those people disappeared. And you see a lot of, you know, kind of smaller law firms that are specialized. That's how I see marketing moving forward. I don't think it goes away as a practice at all. It is as human-centered as any other practice area where you need to do some interpretation and understand it. It does mean and worry me, which would be a completely different podcast, as to how do we establish new experts in marketing when they haven't had to potentially build it from the ground up the way that some of us more experienced people have. So, yeah.
Sort of taking the test without doing any of the studying.
Right. Or knowing that it's wrong. Like Malcolm Gladwell Blink, he talks about, you know, walking into a museum and you can see a statue and even an untrained eye knows that it's kind of a little off, right? Well, how do people know something is a little off? It's always like, that's not exactly right. Like and it's in the nuance. It's in that little bit of difference that makes all the marketing stuff work. Like if it's just a tiny thing, you're like, okay, I get you. I understand why you are the brand you are. It's walking into a space and understanding the brand just based on the way the space is set up. Like that's those intangibles that hopefully AI never replaces. Back in the day, 2 years ago, when you would get something from a more junior resource and it wasn't right, you would push it back and say, no, go fix this and bring it back to me. And now when I receive something, I have my own AI models and I just put it into the AI models and have it fix it. And then I replace the things I know were still wrong. And I don't typically send it back because it's just easier for me to correct it.
Yeah.
But then there's a loss in how people learn. I started my career at IBM and I was on a call desk. And so we had teachers calling us who were trying to install networking systems in their classrooms. And I was like 18 when I started there. And I had to go ask the really, really scary smart people in their office questions based on what I was asking the person. And I wanted to make sure I had all my questions answered correctly. Because if I got there and I didn't, then I was going to get in trouble or I was going to look like an idiot, whatever. We're missing a little bit of that now. Like, how do we do that in a way that's going to make sure we have that authentic practice moving forward and have people who are experts in those categories? It's going to be an interesting thing to solve.
I think it will be. And you know, thinking about entrepreneurs and people listening to this podcast, they're at varying stages, degrees of starting a company. And I think generally that AI has created a world in which it's easier and easier to start a company. However, both you and I have the blood, sweat, and tears of starting a company very slowly, but quickly. You know, you're pushing but you're learning all these things as you go. You're going through, the best word I can use is a crucible to start up a company. While I think many people will have the initial idea that they can go flesh out and get it really far along. They can design an application. They can design a website. They can get the first 80% of many 80% completed. But I think you're going to end up with pretty much the same lasting business result, because while your first steps are bigger and better, I don't know that it's going to matter much in the long run.
Yeah, I agree with that. I hadn't thought about it that way, because one of the things that we've talked about, we definitely talked about in the research days, was the idea of the instant gratification society that we're in, you know, and even when you see a success story, you know, on TV, they such and such started a business and it's amazing, like 2 seconds later, right? So I've always told people 18 months. You got to give it 18 months to know that it's actually a thing. Like it, yeah. And then 3 is at the point that it should stop eating you alive. It's kind of the same thing as having a kid, right? Like for a very long period of time, you have to, and then there's the awkward in between years, which is where something like an EOS starts to help scale it, you know, like when you get it to that point and it's still relying on you too much. And often everybody's like, I'm going to give it a year. And I'm like, well, that's not long enough. So you at least got to give it 18. And I'm not saying that's going to replace income or anything at that point. It's just that it feels less like you're just pouring your heart, your soul, and all of your money into it. So the instant gratification of AI could convince people that yeah, the business should run that. And that's not going to happen. You still got to build all the things around it to make it work. And it is not for the faint of heart. It is not for the faint of heart.
You have to train that grit, train the resilience to create a business that endures. And if you've got this big initial jump forward, do you think that you're going to end up with a lot of people who think that they're entrepreneurs, but they're not? As we were talking about earlier, the rectify, the magnify, and then you're just not?
They're the people who typically don't have the grit for it. It is that kind of stay with it kind of attitude that you have to have, and the ability to pivot and understand when and how to pivot and what that means. It's a stay with it attitude. It's, you know, you're not going to go run a marathon the very first week. Like, all that stuff applies. And it's a tough road, and it's full of a lot of doubt. Like, you talk about entrepreneurs, you know, there's a lot of argument often, even like, what is an entrepreneur? Like, is an entrepreneur somebody who's just done this thing, or is it this? And because people will call themselves entrepreneurs, and it may not truly be that, like they're consulting or something, which there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with it. It's really about looking at that and understanding what it means and what it means to be successful. And what's cool, what's interesting to me, and this is a story I haven't thought about for a while, but when I left IBM, I was in Atlanta, Georgia. At 5 years old, I either wanted to be president of the United States or I wanted to work for IBM. Atlanta, IBM was it. Like, it was it. Like, if you got an IBM, that was the place. And so I planned, I went to high school, and then I went to a college here near Atlanta called North Georgia College, which is a military college. And I'm not a military guy. The reason I went there is they had an amazing program with IBM. And so I ended up at IBM very young. And realized a couple of years into it that I probably didn't love the like 9 to 5 and the corporate and whatever. I ended up in my first startup. When I did that, being an entrepreneur was not cool. Like the movie Big Chill, there's a guy who says he's an entrepreneur and his friends say, oh, that just means he's unemployed, right? Like, it was not cool.
Which it might still be now, I don't know.
Literally. And then all of a sudden it became this like rock star status. It was, you know, oh, you're going to be an entrepreneur. And we ended up with shows like Shark Tank and things like that. So it's been glamorized in a way that is not appropriate. And I'm going to say that on one side, and then I'm going to say something completely different that sounds counterintuitive to it. There's a book called Fourth Turning, and it talks about kind of return to village and selling your skills to companies versus having a company sell your skills on your behalf. And I do think with AI and some of the things we're seeing with the economy, it's a much safer place to be. If you can figure out how to take what you do and sell it to multiple companies, then you're in a safer place, because if one doesn't need you any longer, you didn't lose all your income. You now have others, right? So there's this weird dichotomy of it wasn't cool, it became a rock star thing, but I also think it's a really good idea for people to understand what they like to do and like to do well, and control their own destiny.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. A lot of young people I've been hearing are really, they're not necessarily building a personal brand, as opposed to, they work for a company, but instead of embodying that company, they're building their own personal brand. They're building their own personal skills. And then they will work for 2, 3, 4 big organizations, Fortune 500 companies, in full-time jobs, and because of remote work, because really the recognition that most big organizations, people don't really work that much. And so younger people are really realizing like, oh, I could actually do the same thing for 4 companies simultaneously, still have time left over, and I'm making 3 to 4x what I would have made anyway. And it's just about my skills for hire. And I think that's really kind of obvious, honestly.
It is. And it's a guy early in my career talked about, you know, if I go to work for a company and I got laid off, then I lost my income. If I go out and I sell my services to 10 companies and one lets me go, I still have 9. So it's a very different, interesting way to look at the world. And regrettably, it's not taught as well as it, like, you learn this kind of like school of hard knocks, right? Like how to put it together, what it looks like, how to make it work. So thinking about maybe we did need a different word. I don't know that you and I can come up with it today, but you know, entrepreneur means one thing, and then you've got the, and I mean, people call it solopreneur or whatever, but like this, what is it you do well? What do you want to do? What's going to make you happy moving through life? And then figuring out how to get in front of the right customers and companies to do that.
Yeah. Awesome. So thinking, going back to Liger, you have your ambition, you're looking for M&A. You mentioned looking for companies who don't have that operational capability, skill. Any other attributes that should a marketing firm be listening to this podcast that you're looking for?
Really important to us is cultural fit. We know that, and 90% of M&As fail because culture doesn't align. That's what they say. I think there's some other things underneath it, but it's a good thing to look at. Like, how do the cultures align? So we are looking for culturally aligned businesses to what we do and how we work. We find often in the category we're looking at, they don't have huge staff, which is part of the reason they're having issues scaling. So that is something we can bring to them and just figure out who we can graft in, right? Someone who is also equally interested in continuing to practice what they're doing. They just may not want the day-to-day craziness of approving payroll and doing review, like some of the stuff that those people hate to do, right? And if you get into classic EOS world, it's probably a visionary who's running a business without a good integrator. Like they need someone in the kind of arbitrating those things and, you know, moving that forward. We kind of kid that Liger is like a hippie company with a lot of structure. Like we're very hippie, you know, we're very, you know, but we have a lot of structure. We have a way we do things and a way that it looks and works, which those two things don't feel like they would go together, but they do. And it works really well in a creative space, right? For creatives. So we found in this space, it's not, there's some M&A and PE work that we've seen where, you know, there's, this is someone they're selling their business because they're kind of in it. They're at the end of their career and there's no other way out. For these, it's typically going to be somebody who's probably got 5 to 10 years left and they really do want to continue to do the work. They just don't want to do the work alone. Like they're tired of being alone and have and are looking for a tribe to live with that is going to, you know, have kind of similar values and goals. If they are looking for the big PE buyout or payout at the end of the day, that is not my interest. So I am interested in creating a nice cash generating machine, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Not at all. So if you want to wear moon boots, dance under a disco ball, and vote for Pedro, that's who you're looking for.
We look for margin. Like, how do we provide people with that nice, you know, this, the word work-life balance, which, you know, we don't care when and how people do things as long as the work gets done. Like, it's a very results-based company. I always have been. I've never understood why you needed to see somebody's face in the office for a certain period of time when maybe they'd be more effective at work. But there are also times you need to get together because things are going to just happen faster than the, you know, eternal Zoom call.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sometimes you just need a whiteboard.
You just need a whiteboard. Oh, my gosh. That is my, I have 240 square feet of whiteboard in my space, which my COO says is the strangest flex ever, but it is my favorite place to be. Like a clean whiteboard, markers, and we can invent the world.
There's just something so efficient and gratifying standing at a whiteboard with a group of 3 to 5 people just brainstorming, just getting in. You see your handiwork and you're just clear, same page, and you did it in such a small amount of time versus having to click everywhere. And I actually don't think it's age related. I see this with younger people. I think it's just a human thing.
It's a human thing, and it drives into people's learning styles. So I'm an auditory learner. Some people are visual learners. Some people need to see it written out. Like if you think about it, a whiteboard experience is all of that. Like you're hearing somebody say it, they're drawing it, they're writing it, like all the things that need to reinforce it quickly. And you get on, you know, Zoom calls, you don't even know, is everybody, are you really here? Do you understand what I'm saying? I speak fast for a Southerner, like where are we, right? So I love to be able to work wherever I want to. And I know that there are times we just need to get people in a room. And when we do strategy onboarding for clients, we insist on an in-person session somewhere where we can really get down to what's going to be the strategy to establish moving us forward.
Yeah, love it. Well, Eric, my final question for you, if you had to go back in time speaking to younger Eric, just starting out, sitting at IBM, taking phone calls, talking to teachers, what's the one piece of advice you would give him?
Probably to enjoy the process more. So I have so many interesting experiences. I've done so much and I am moving on to the next thing, you know, like I'm, whatever. And so like just understanding that the journey is the destination. So like you are in that part of it and it's going to suck, but you know, smell the roses a little bit and think about the fact that you're getting to do this cool, interesting thing that so many other people don't get to do, right? And that's something I have to constantly remind myself of. I'm a present future thinker, so I'm always thinking about the future, but how do I get there today? And that keeps you from not always being fully present in the moment that you are not promised. You're not promised that you're going to have the 10 years or the whatever. Like, what are you doing with what you're experiencing right now? So yeah,
love it. All right, Eric, thank you for coming on. Thanks for your time and good luck with Liger.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
If this conversation gave you something to think about, I'd love to keep that going. I write a newsletter called Clarity Break Thoughts, where I share simple ideas, questions, and reminders to help you step back, think clearly, and lead with more intention. You can subscribe at eosworldwide.com/claritybreakthoughts. Again, that's eosworldwide.com/claritybreakthoughts.